Please silence all electronic devices.
Trump admitted this week that he is intentionally attempting to suppress the vote. He said he is withholding funding from the U.S. Postal Service because he doesn't want people to vote by mail.
He's going to need some money to do it, and he's not going to get any outside money unless the big bucks Republicans think he has a chance. And right now, if they look at the numbers, I'm guessing they don't think he has a chance.
Any further discussion or debate?
From the Auxiliary, 4th Estate Bunker in northern Wake County, this is the WUNC Politics Podcast. I'm Jeff Tiberi. Good of you to download and click play, as always. Time again for a review of some of what happened in the week in state politics. Mitch Kokot from the John Locke Foundation is in this week in for Becky Gray. And as usual, Rob Schofield from NC Policy Watch is part of our discussion as well. Hey, guys.
Gentlemen.
Thank you, Jeff.
We're recording midday via Zoom. Republican Dan Forrest is challenging Democrat Roy Cooper in the gubernatorial race. Forrest recently challenged Cooper's executive authority in court, contending the governor's coronavirus-related executive orders went too far. On Tuesday, a judge ruled against Forrest and dismissed the lawsuit. Forrest will not appeal. He's facing a popular incumbent who is benefiting from a lot of exposure these past few months. Where does he go from here? Mitch?
Well, in terms of the lawsuit, he doesn't go anywhere. I think he's decided he's not doing that. And I think, regardless of the outcome, it was important in terms of trying to deal with the issue of the rule of law and the possible constitutional problems created by the governor acting on his own. It was a good idea for him to go forward. He was unsuccessful. Now I think he needs to shift back to trying to present to voters a reason why he is a good alternative to Roy Cooper, and that's going to be tough. As you said, popular incumbent. So far, although the popularity rating has gone down, Roy Cooper remains well over 50% in terms of his approval rating. When you look at head-to-head matchups between Roy Cooper and Dan Forrest, Cooper continues to have a sizable lead. So it's going to be difficult for Dan Forrest not only to tackle that mountain, but also he's going to need some money to do it, and he's not going to get any outside money unless the big bucks Republicans think he has a chance. And right now, if they look at the numbers, I'm guessing they don't think he has a chance.
Yes, I agree with Mitch. I think it was a reckless Hail Mary by Forrest, but he really didn't have many cards to play. He's in a really tough spot with respect to the election. I think at this point, he's just going to have to try to be a good Republican soldier and avoid a blowout. He's going to have to keep running. I think the die is cast when it comes to the outcome of the election, barring some amazing unforeseen incident. You know, the lawsuit, I hear what Mitch is saying about in terms of it's a principle to try and vindicate the rule of law, but the rule of law can't be that the Council of State on something like this acts as a mini legislature, which is in effect what he was arguing would be the case. I can't imagine a judge ruling that. We obviously need to have the governor in charge. That's what he's the head of the executive branch. I really think Forrest has gotten some bad advice. I actually think he would have been much better served early on in the pandemic to take a more statesman-like position to sort of align himself and with Cooper, say, look, I've got some differences with the governor, let me outline them, but to go for this sort of all-out, all-the-time attack and then identify himself as the man who questions the usefulness of masks and to hold events in which masks are not being used, I think he's gone way over the edge, and I think he's in a really tough spot at this point. And I don't think any national money is going to be coming in to rescue him.
I think on the bit of statesmanship, it really cuts both ways as well, though, because Roy Cooper would have avoided the whole lawsuit if, at the beginning of his shutdown orders, he had gone to the Council of State with a plan and said, "Look, this COVID-19 pandemic is such a big deal. We need to shut down the restaurants. Here's why. Here's the data." I'm guessing, you know, Dan Forrest may have disagreed because he's his political opponent, but he probably could have secured a majority of the Council of State to go along with him. And then this would not have been an issue. Dan Forrest would not have even had a leg to stand on. As it is, basically that lawsuit came down to whether the State Emergency Management Act, one piece of it, that said that the governor has to get concurrence of the Council of State, whether that was the piece that he had to rely on, or did he rely on the next section that said he could move forward with some emergency measures in his own discretion. And there was a legitimate legal dispute about which section of the Emergency Management Act applied. The judge in the case, Judge Gale, sided with the governor's interpretation and did not side with the lieutenant governor's interpretation. I think the ruling was strong enough against him that Dan Forrest knew it wasn't going to go anywhere, and that's why the case ended.
Well, I agree with that. I do think it would have been an enormous roll of the dice, though, for Governor Cooper to sort of, at the very beginning of this, to sort of abdicate responsibility and say, oh, I'm going to have to run this by Dan Forrest and Cherie Berry and the state auditor and the ag commissioner before I can take, you know, immediate action to save people's lives and health. So that would have been a very strange action for a governor to take, I think. And so I think he knew he was on sound legal footing and decided he would just take the chance of being sued.
Well, one thing that has struck me about the dynamics of pushing back against Cooper's executive orders has been, as I think about the gubernatorial race versus the Senate race, and I'm interested just to hear briefly if either of you have been struck by this, because I was thinking about it this week and I thought, Dan Forrest challenged this. He challenged this early. He made this argument of process, as we're talking about here. But Tom Tillis didn't. Tom Tillis never made that argument. And my thought was, well, he didn't have to, right? Tom Tillis is in somewhat of a more advantageous position because he has his own hard race to fight, but he's not going up against a guy who's been on television day after day after day after day. And I'm wondering how much of it really is a principled stance for Forrest versus he has to do something because Cooper's popularity continues to rise. Does that make sense? It might not make sense.
No, you're making sense. And I think that there is a bit of both of it. I mean, I think he is making a principled stance saying the Council of State has a role. But it also, if he had won, would have been politically advantageous for him. And another reason why Tom Tillis would not necessarily come out and say anything is that it really doesn't have anything to do with his job as a U.S. senator. I mean, he has the right as a North Carolinian to have an opinion about what Governor Roy Cooper does, but he doesn't have any role anymore in state government. And so has less of a reason to step out unless he is completely making a political point.
Yeah, Tillis has enough problems just trying to survive, I guess, with Donald Trump overshadowing everything he does and having basically attached himself at the hip to the Trump administration. He probably didn't need to create another enemy and take on a popular governor in his home state. He's, to my way of analyzing the situation, has pretty much been just keeping his head down and trying to hang on and stay out of harm's way politically. And so that would have been a bit of a roll of the dice for him as well.
Meanwhile, Governor Cooper said Thursday that the state will go forward with a matching federal-state program to provide additional unemployment benefits. For each recipient, the state provides $100 a week. $300 would come from the federal government. Earlier in the week, Senate Leader Phil Berger and House Speaker Tim Moore called on Cooper to opt in to this proposal set forth by President Trump via an executive order. So naturally, just smooth sailing from here on out. Right, guys? Rob?
I just was so struck by, here we have Berger and Moore, two men who have led a sustained decade almost long assault on unemployment insurance. ProPublica wrote an article at the end of June, this is a national media outlet, in which they said, which was entitled How North Carolina Became the Worst State in the Union to Be Unemployed. And it's all a function of the things that Berger and Moore and Tillis, when he was in charge, did to eviscerate North Carolina's unemployment insurance system. Basically take it to the bottom of the pack nationally so that it hardly helps anybody for any length of time with any amount of money. And now here, all of a sudden, they're champions of unemployment insurance. Well, isn't that nice? Arguing that we got to get behind the Trump package for unemployment insurance. The reality is that Trump has given us a disastrous non-plan to deal with the pandemic this fall. This unemployment package he's come up with, which appears only to be temporarily funded, is going to replace two-thirds of the benefit that was barely keeping people hanging in there. Cooper doesn't have any choice in the matter because Congress has abdicated its responsibility to negotiate a package, and Trump abetted that process. So, I mean, that's what we're stuck with right now, and a lot of unemployed people are going to get a big cut in their reimbursements or in their benefit very shortly, thanks to this. And the rest of Trump's package is just completely useless for unemployed people. So it was really rather remarkable this week that Trump said that pretty much takes care of everything, takes care of the situation, which it does nothing of the kind. We've got so many needs, local government, schools, contact tracing. There's so many things that this federal package should have dealt with. It doesn't do anything on.
to me, the thing that struck me most about this was the fact that the sides in this debate, Governor Cooper on one side and Republican legislative leaders on the other, agreed, yet couldn't just agree. They had to fight about it first. And, you know, you mentioned Berger and Moore accusing Cooper of not wanting to go along with what President Trump put forward. And then Cooper firing back that, hey, he made the exact same argument, basically, that Rob just did, that you've eviscerated the unemployment system. So you have no reason to talk. But they both wanted the same thing, which was an extension of the federal unemployment benefits. And both sides significantly were willing to put in the state government match, because this is unlike the original $600 a week benefit. This one requires $100 a week to be paid by state government. And all sides were in agreement, but we're in the political state we are. So rather than just say, yes, we're going to go along with it, whether we think it's the best option or not, they had to fight about it first and then eventually grumble their way into an agreement.
Some 200,000 North Carolina voters have now requested an absentee vote-by-mail ballot for the November election. That's eight times as many who asked to vote by mail at this point 4 years ago. And there are lingering concerns about whether the U.S. Postal Service can handle the load. Hardly inspiring news from the top, either. We learned this week that Postmaster General Louis DeJoy, a mega-Trump donor from Greensboro, happened to invest in Amazon. That's a USPS competitor, of course, after starting his current job. Calls for an ethics investigation have followed. What, if anything, can be done either here or nationally to fight this, remedy this? What, if anything, can be done? Rob?
I mean, you really can't make this stuff up. Trump admitted this week that he is intentionally attempting to suppress the vote. He said he is withholding funding from the U.S. Postal Service because he doesn't want people to vote by mail. This is the same president who then, like an hour or two later, requested an absentee ballot so he could vote by mail. I mean, it's really stunning. I mean, frankly, the amount of mail that will be processed when it comes to processing absentee ballots, even if everybody voted by mail, I mean, it's really not that much mail. People send, we have hundreds of billions of pieces of mail every day. The Postal Service ought to be able to process it without much trouble. But when you've got the head of the Postal Service and the President of the United States doing everything they can to undermine the election, DeJoy, this Louis DeJoy character, came in and started firing people in the USPS. There's reason to believe that some of the people fired were the people who were overseeing sort of the political mail channels that go through the Postal Service. I mean, it's just a stunning admission by the president, a stunning bit of behavior. I don't know what we can do to fix it other than that people should vote early if they're going to vote by mail, get their ballots in quickly, and buy masks to go vote in person if you're going to do it. But, I mean, I think the sad thing here and the tragic thing is that it's going to hurt everybody to have the president trying to undermine the election. There are plenty of states in this country that do nothing but vote by mail and have done it that way for a long time. They're deeply red Republican states like Utah. So it's just another amazing bit of outrageous behavior by Trump that, you know, I guess we shouldn't be surprised by.
Well, the interesting thing on Trump and mail-in balloting is that he exemplifies one of the bizarre pieces of this debate, and that is that there is support among some for absentee balloting, and among the same people, opposition to mail-in balloting, even though it's the same thing. The circumstances are different. Mail-in balloting, as it's opposed, is the situation in which the state mails a ballot to every potential voter, whereas in a system like ours, absentee balloting, you have to request it and go through a process. So there's been a lot of confusion about this. I think Louis DeJoy is exactly right in some respects, and that is that we have a financially unsustainable U.S. Postal Service that's based on a broken business model. But certainly the timing of the changes that he makes right in the middle of concerns about a pandemic and about the fact that we're going to have many more mail-in ballots raises a lot of questions. And of course, we even heard Alma Adams, the North Carolina congresswoman, say on, I don't know if it was on the floor of the House or in a debate somewhere, that she thought that DeJoy was engaging in unconstitutional sabotage of the postal system. So whatever happens with the balloting for the elections this fall, I think Louis DeJoy is not going to come out of it looking really good.
It's worth noting that, though, that this is not something new. There has been a sustained conservative attack on the Postal Service for decades. It's an ideological attack. It's also been driven by people like DeJoy, who have financial interests in companies that compete with the Postal Service. I would argue that it's not based on a flawed model. The Postal Service has simply been underfunded. There have been requirements by government, the U.S. government, in terms of how it takes care of its pensions. The Postal Service is enormously popular. It's one of the most important institutions for employing ex-veterans from the military. It has helped lift hundreds of thousands, if not millions, of people of color into the middle class. It is an enormously popular and essential public institution, and the efforts to undermine it, both for the past several decades and most recently, are reprehensible.
The U.S. Postal Service also hemorrhages money. It loses lots and lots, billions and billions of dollars a year. And there is a different marketplace than there was 240 years ago in the U.S. or 200 plus years ago when the U.S. Postal Service started. Do you think the U.S. Postal Service still needs to operate 6 days a week, to deliver 6 days a week?
There are vast swaths of our country where people are getting their, you know, their diabetes medications and their heart pills delivered by the Postal Service in rural, for instance, North Carolina, where I'm sure people would say, absolutely, where you know, UPS and some of the private companies are not going to be operating. The USPS, with the proper nurturing and the proper attention and the proper dealing with issues like pension matters, could be quite sustainable and indeed ought to be expanded to take on a lot of other public services that it could be providing. And I think there's plenty of room for the Postal Service to have a rich, successful future throughout the 21st century, and I hope very much that the next administration starts to take things in that direction.
Rob has alluded to one of the problems with the Postal Service, and that is because of decisions of past politicians years ago, you end up with problems funding a pension program, which is the same thing that we've seen in some major businesses. I mean, for a while, the automakers were retirement funds that also put out some cars. If the Postal Service continues the way it is, it's basically just going to be a pension system that also happens to deliver mail every once in a while, and it will not compete very well in doing that with the Amazons and the UPS and FedEx. And that's a situation that needs to be resolved, whether you like what Louis DeJoy is doing or would like some other option. It can't continue on as it is. It's not sustainable.
Finally, Kamala Harris is the running mate of presumptive Democratic presidential nominee Joe Biden. The California senator is the first person of color to appear as vice president on a major party ticket. It seemed everyone put their prognosticator hats on this week. So, guys, your turn. What might the selection of Harris mean for voter trends here in North Carolina?
I'm not sure what it's going to do for voter turnout. I mean, certainly the people who are going to vote for Donald Trump don't like Kamala Harris. They wouldn't have liked anyone he would have chosen. The people who hate Donald Trump were going to vote for whoever is going to be the vice presidential pick for Joe Biden. Where this really will have an impact is people who were sort of lukewarm and maybe weren't going to vote. And I think you get two different sides of the coin with Senator Harris. One is that she has a pretty good record in terms of the policy positions she wants to put out for progressives, that they should like what she's talked about doing. On the flip side, some might look at her record, especially prior to being a senator when she was a prosecutor, and say, wait a minute, during this era of wanting to defund the police or scale back the law enforcement, here was a person who was a very active prosecutor. Will that diminish support for Senator Harris as she's the vice presidential candidate? I don't think so, but it might. There might be some progressives out there who might otherwise get excited about her being on the ticket who would say, I have some misgivings. I don't think that's going to happen. I think the people who are supporters of Joe Biden are going to welcome the pick. The people who are supporters of Donald Trump are going to be against the pick, and it probably will be a wash in the end.
I think it helps Biden to the extent that she'll probably spur some enthusiasm amongst women, voters of color, but they're already very fired up. I don't think there are any progressives who are going to sit out the election because Kamala Harris used to be a prosecutor. But the main thing she does is what all good vice presidential candidates do, and that's that she doesn't hurt the ticket. because and since Biden is winning and is well ahead in the polls, both here in North Carolina and nationally, that's good for him because you want to pick a vice presidential ticket mate, or running mate who is safe, who doesn't, you know, start bringing negatives to the campaign. I've been struck by how the Trump people have really been flailing, and it's further evidence that she doesn't bring many negatives that they've been going to these racist tropes. They've been trying to pull out the birther stuff. One part of the Trump camp saying she's too liberal, another part of the Trump camp saying she's too conservative. They really can't make anything stick. She's a talented campaigner. It'll be very interesting to see her debate Mike Pence. And it doesn't seem to me there's any chance it's going to hurt unless there's something that comes to light that we don't know about.
And on that front, I think the thing that's most helpful about the selection for Joe Biden of Kamala Harris is because she was a presidential candidate, I would guess almost anything that could come out has come out by now. And there may be something else, but because she's already gone through the gauntlet herself, at least for the early part of the presidential run, most anything bad that would have come out about Kamala Harris is out now.
Mitch Kokai, senior policy analyst at the John Locke Foundation. Rob Schofield is director of NC Policy Watch. Enjoy your weekends.
All right, guys. Peace. Take care.
And a quick programming note. We will be off the next couple of weeks, taking a summer break. The week in state politics, we call it Around the Office, or our remote working spaces, WISP. And you can catch that each Friday in your podcast feeds. Also, you can hear it on the radio, a portion of our conversation, 4:50 on Friday afternoons. Glad to have you along for the Politics Pod Drop. Would encourage you to check out some other recent episodes as well. We had a conversation with former four-term Governor Jim Hunt that dropped earlier this week. And next conversation out will be with Kate Martin of Carolina Public Press, a journalist who has been covering very closely the pandemic. If you have not yet done so, encourage you to go download and listen to some episodes of Tested, as well as a new podcast from WUNC. It is called Embodied. For Rob and Mitch, my name is Jeff. Enjoy your weekend. We'll talk to you again soon.